I am now recording. Welcome to the call, and please mind the Hyperledger Code of Conduct and the antitrust policy as well. If you'll add yourself, to invite you to add yourself to the list of attendees for this particular meeting. I think I might recognize everyone here today. Anyone who would like to introduce themselves that hasn't before? All right. Hyperledger is going on this week, and I anticipate that next week we will have a report of the goings on. From posts on Twitter, I know that the presentations have been going well and lots of interesting topics. I've heard it is a little bit lighter attended than usual. It's usually quite the big event, simply because of the difficulty of travel with the virus going around. So. And on that note, IAW is April 28th through 30th. Phil has made the comment that by the end of April, they'll be making the decision, or sorry, by the end of March, they'll be making the decision about IAW based on the current recommendations of health organizations, et cetera, about whether to hold IAW. And I know that he is at least considering a virtual option if that can't happen, so that we can still have at least part of the experience if we can't all gather together. So a little bit of news around there. In any case, whether it's virtual or in person, that's a great way to be involved, and encourage you to do so if you can. Any other announcements that I don't have on my list? All right. Related meetings review. This week's DidCom working group at the DIF was relatively lightly attended for the same reasons as this one. And then do we have any reps that can report on the other meetings that we had this week?
Yeah, it's Paul here. So we had the semantics call last night, or yesterday daytime your time. We were just talking about, so we're just going through a data sharing model at the moment with some of the big pharma companies. So we kind of fleshed out some of the flow of that on the credential flow with Stephen Curran. So I presented that during the call, and it looked like quite a popular model. It was a good call, and pressing on.
Excellent. And these are the notes for that. Did you link?
I will make sure that, yeah, I think they are. I think they're always a generic link.
Oh, okay. Perfect. That will work. Awesome. And Daniel, you're joining us from the conference, I believe. Maybe. All right. So, thank you, Paul, for that report. Any other related meetings? Also, someone's been scribbling on my screen.
Hey, yes, I am joining you from the conference. Sorry about that. Zoom was being funny for me.
No worries. I'll take a minute. That's right. It's in the annotate menu. Cool. Are you schedule restricted, Daniel? We'd love to hear how the conference is going, if you've got a minute.
I'm not. I can talk whenever. You want me to talk now?
let's go through the work updates. I think that'll be relatively fast, and then let's stick you first, because that would be really good. Okay. On work updates, what do we want to? Who's here? Troy's here. How's Framework Go going?
It's going.
Excellent.
Posted the usual notes, and we're working on the JavaScript controller APIs to finish it off, exposing credential presentation APIs, and looking at issue credential.
Awesome. Andrew, do you have an update for Cloud Engine Python?
We just put out 0.4.4 and 0.4.5 this week, mainly just fixing up little issues we'd found around
presentation verification.
Yeah, the sort of pre-verification that we do on top of how the SDK verifies the math of the presentation. We verify that, cool, you know, all the requested attributes are actually there.
Awesome. I did see, I was wandering around earlier and saw the 045. So that's very cool. Other reports, I'm looking at my list. Other work progress reports from this week. All right. The agenda today is fairly light. For the issue game, we don't have any to close. But I did want to draw attention to the out of band RFC, that's a PR, and that's linked here. And there's been a lot of conversation there. I'll get into that in a minute. And then what I'd like to do for our, we're relatively light on numbers, but I do know that we have regular people that listen to the recording. I would like to review the progress made on the message type transition in 0348. And there, we have three examples of how that was done. And then I have a related question about the discovered feature protocol and how that goes through. So that's on the agenda, but we're going to, at the beginning here, stick Daniel Hardman with a quick Hyperledger Global Forum update.
So the group of us that's down here is having a good time in Phoenix. There's a large group of people, but it's smaller than it was at Basel. And I think it might be because of the coronavirus issue. There were some comments that were made in the keynote talking about how there were kind of last minute cancellations and changes to things. And so I'm kind of reading between the lines, but you know, we're all bumping elbows instead of shaking hands and stuff like that. So the numbers are a little bit light here at the conference, but it's been a very interesting conference. We have lots of discussions going on about topics that you would predict. Many of them are not identity topics. Some of them are just kind of general blockchain things, supply chain things, and so forth. What's interesting to me is I've seen some conversations about DIDs that have nothing to do with digital identity. So there are people that are exploring DIDs entirely because they want to, you know, do supply chain problems or things like that. So that was kind of an interesting learning for me. And the other thing that I find really exciting and interesting is that we now have people that are showing up and talking about their experience implementing systems. We're not talking about developers in our crowd here. We're talking about people one level removed from us. These are like credit unions. There was a guy from a credit union that talked about using verifiable credentials and Hyperledger Indy to solve certain problems. And he wasn't a developer. He was a business guy saying, this is our experience with the credit union putting this stuff into production and what we've learned from it. And there's a fabulous presentation from Kiva about how they have solved certain problems in Sierra Leone. And so what we're seeing is a maturation of the ecosystem, and the conversations are now a lot more business and kind of human oriented and less technical in some ways. We still have plenty of technical conversations happening, but it's fun to see these other conversations start to get equal billing in the conference.
Very cool. It's really neat to see. It's a delight when you stumble into somebody working on something that you didn't know they were working on. So that's a fun experience.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool. And I appreciate that. And I'm looking forward to a more roundtable discussion of kind of how the conference went and learnings and stuff next week after the conference is over. So thank you for sharing a bit with us. Is there anything that ought to be on the agenda this week that isn't, that we might want to spend time on? If it isn't, we will likely end a little bit early, which is just fine. We don't need to hold airtime for the sake of airtime. But if there is a topic that someone would like to discuss, then that would be useful. Okay, I'll bring that up again at the end. So the first thing in the spirit of the issue game here is a PR made by Stephen Curran. We have previously talked about the out-of-band RFC here on the call, and his PR has the has you know the results of that as he's written it in here. The out-of-band RFC again is a the idea there is to replace the invitation phase of either connections or did exchange such that you can launch into either one of them as supported. And we anticipate that this will help solve problems like that in the future. There are some discussions about the nature of that. I've gone through, there's a handful, George, you had a lot of super helpful comments. In wherever they were marked resolved, I just resolved the comment just for the sake of brevity, trying to read stuff. So resolved conversations are, have been collapsed a little bit, but I left all the ones open that weren't just simple ones like that. And so there's some discussions about the template, and then some larger discussions about the effects of various things. And so we don't need to necessarily review all of them here, but the discussion is quite good. And so if you are interested in the topic, then I would please take a pass on this and have some attention there. So that's good. Is there any comments anyone wants to make on this before I move along?
I'd like to make one process comment.
Sure.
We said that generally speaking, a proposal should be relatively easy to merge. And there's a lot of comments. I'm one of the people that commented a lot, and I was pushing back pretty hard on a subset of this PR. I really like the general concept, but I just wanted a particular detail to change. But anyway, I wonder if, you know, if we're following our process, does that mean that we just go ahead and merge it? This, if we did, it would be a proposal like any other RFC, but it would be a proposal that's already had some intense conversation and back and forth. What's our preference about how to manage something that's excited a bunch of intense conversation as opposed to something that seems really uncontroversial, but at the proposal stage?
I'm no judge and jury here, but my feeling about it is that PRs make really good blackboards, if you will, to have a conversation against. And so when there is conversation, I think that we should continue to have it here. If it turns into something that is preferable to the actual text, I think issues might be the better place to do that and just, then just approve the PR. But given that it's about a lot of this stuff, I find it very useful to actually have the conversation in the context of the document. So it is a little bit outside of the process that we've talked about before, but I feel like it's a really active ongoing conversation and that this is kind of a healthy way to have it. So we're sort of not following the rules, and I'm kind of okay with that. Any other thoughts?
Yeah, I think that makes sense to me because the alternative is just merging it and then immediately creating an issue to discuss more changes.
That was why I wasn't opposed to this happening. George, you've commented a lot. Any thoughts?
No, I'm okay with merging it. I expressed an issue there that aligned well with Daniel Hardman's regarding the lack of, that this first cut does not specify the goal of the interaction or of the connection that will be the result of this exchange of messages. However, we actually internally here, we realized that there is still some way to make it work with the request message. So I'm okay with it for now. Anything else can be left for future issues or PR.
Okay. My inclination is to keep the conversation going as long as it's healthy, with some allowance for the conference going on and people are, you know, busy presenting and stuff like that. And so that's often hard to get the time in for that. But I think that we should seek to merge it as soon as reasonable. And if the conversation reaches sort of a stalling point, then we're probably ready to the point where we need to turn those things into issues and then merge the PR. But it's been really useful. And a lot of the comments you made, George, were useful corrections that Stephen, fixed and feature commits on the PR. So, so that's really useful to happen. Is that a good enough answer, Daniel?
Sorry, I had my mouth full. Yeah, I just didn't want anybody to feel like I was trying to block a PR from getting merged. You know, I have a particular viewpoint I'm pursuing, but I don't want to hold up a process if we think it needs to move forward. So either way, I'm good with, but I do want to continue the conversation.
Yeah, me too. I'm very happy to let it continue so long as the conversation is useful and productive. And then let's all call it by year when it's time to merge it and then continue the topic discussions and issues. I think that seems like a good way to move forward. Cool. Parting comments on this particular PR and the comments there.
I just clicked on approve for whatever that's worth in favor of merging it now and like continuing discussions in other issues, but you know, that's fine.
Perfect. Okay. Let's do that. I also have no desire to hold it up necessarily, but it is useful to have the conversation in the context of the document so long as that's useful. So, but I suspect that by the end of this week or early next week, we'll probably be at that phase and can get it in there. So excellent. Okay. What I want to talk about today, we have RFC 0348, which is the transition of message type to HTTPS away from the DID that we're using. The summary covers this well. Basically, the prefix that we had been using for this is here, and we're moving to this. And this describes the process of making that happen. And we're currently in step one, which is where during this phase, we update our code bases to accept both the new and the old format and then continue on as useful. Sending out the old format whenever we initiate messages ourselves. And if we do that, then we can, we'll prep for step two, which is we can switch to sending out the new information, but we should be able to receive it by then. So here's the RFC. And what I wanted to do was visit the code bases briefly. There's three code bases that we have that have commits for it, and I should mention that the at the bottom here is a table with the idea of tracking sort of what the steps we are in. So the code changes I'm pulling are just the code changes that are linked here. We have the Aries Toolbox, the Aries Cloud Agent Python, and Pico Labs. Pico Labs, I have to give credit for being first. And I was going to look quickly at their code bases and about the strategies that were taken to accomplish step one. Is there any questions or meta commentary about the transition RFC before we do so? I want to give anyone a chance that isn't familiar or has a question to get that resolved. Okay, let's go look through. The first one that I was going to look at in the sake of here we go. This is the commit out of the Pico Labs code base. And there's a handful of things here that are related to abstracting, basically pulling the magic value out of the, pulling a prefix value out. You can change it in one place, but the really relevant piece is right down here in these few lines. They are extracting the message type and pulling it apart with a regular expression, and what this commit does, what Bruce has done here, is it runs both this one with the old value in place and this one, and it will fail if there's not a matched value there. So if this particular one doesn't start, then it'll drop to didcom to be able to extract that message type out, and then he's modified the code here to be able to pull a success from either one of those, and so that's the particular strategy that he took. So this is the meat of it, and the rest of this is simply using a value to hold the prefix so that it can be changed in one place. So this is written in this specific language of the Pico Lab stuff. So it may not be, it may not look as familiar to you as some other stuff, but the regular expression piece is the relevant piece there. The second code base This is Aries Cloud Agent Python, and I grabbed the commit that Nick Rempel wrote. And what they've done here, the pattern is similar throughout, so let me just grab one and we can view the file. So this is TrustPing, and let me bring it up in context here. They have the base URI here, the protocol URI, and then they use that value as Bruce was migrating to use as a prefix for these other ones. And what they've done is they've added a new protocol URI that contains the new value, and then they've added new message types using that protocol base. And then they now have four where there was two. So there's the original ping and ping response, and then there's the new ping and the new ping response with the with the values corresponding here. So that's the idea. And then the way the AcroPy codebase works is it uses these message types files and the various modules in order to route messages. And you'll notice, for example, that the ping, the old ping and the new ping both route to the same handler. So that's how they're wiring it together. The code that processes the message is the same, but that's how they're doing. And they've done this for each module. I showed TrustPing here, and there's a number of modules in that same commit that this has been done for. And that way, when the message shows up with either the old or the new, they'll accept the message and process it the same way, which is, of course, what step one requires. And then the third way that I wanted to highlight real quick is I pulled this out of the Aries toolbox. And we've migrated and made that change as well there. And we have this process inbound message is called upon receipt of a message from the connected agent. So when you connect to something like AcroPy and it's moving messages back and forth, what it does in particular here, the process of registering for the messages is in a separate place. But this is the added code here, and I've marked it with comments so that it's easy to pull out or modify as we move through the other steps of implementing 348. But what it does is it extracts the message type and then emits that message onto a message bus, and then listeners on the message bus can receive and process those messages by type. And so what we've done for step one is we have both the old and the new values here, and we just have a simple logic here. If the message type starts with the new one, then we're going to replace the new one with the old one and modify that message on the way through, so that any of the listeners that are subscribed to the old one will also receive any of the new ones that have been modified back to the old one. And then, of course, with further steps, we'll do other things, and eventually we'll switch the internal representation to the new one, and we'll reverse this replace logic so that it replaces the old reference with the new one, and then similarly, all the rest of the code can be handled. So I wanted to cover those real quick to kind of outline the different approaches taken in these particular code bases. Obviously, the right place to make that change is heavily dependent on the code base and about how it's organized. But I wanted to sort of bring these up since we were in the community process of doing this, and hopefully this is helpful. Any comments on these approaches or the process of step one or what's required? No comments, no questions.
So we're just replacing a prefix here, but we're not changing the version number of any of the APIs.
That's what I had understood we were doing, was just swapping that out. So in the thing that, here we go. We're just replacing the prefix for that. So here's the before and the after example, the version number and that being the same. So whatever's passed in, with the old prefix would be translated to the new prefix.
Okay. Have we later in 348, did we declare what the lifespan of the workaround is going to be, or is that to be determined still?
Well, each step needs to be determined as it happens, so because we need to move along as a community. And I think, I forget the original target date set to have step one done, but I think it was coming up that we wanted to sort of get that done. The point, though, is that we were setting that as a sort of a target altogether with the need to follow up and see how everyone's doing so that we can not move to step two until we're all ready. So that's kind of a fuzzy answer, Daniel, but here we go. Target completion date 2/29. So we're now past that by a weekish, or at least a couple of days. We're not there yet, obviously. And so, we've got some work to do. We'll need to pick a date and move towards that. But yeah, anyway, I think that was the goal. We clearly haven't met it as a community, but there's a lot of things that factor into it, including production schedules and release cadence and all sorts of things. And so it's to be expected that we're not going to all complete on the same day.
Okay.
Other thoughts, comments, questions? So the good news is that it doesn't appear to be a huge, massive change, which is good. And it is a relatively, depending on the organization, the code base, you know, you might be able to insert it in one spot as done here or in Pico Labs or in the Airs Cloud Agent Python, a little bit of logic was added to the message types in order to route messages to a similar place. But however it happens, it should, doesn't seem like a lot of work, at least from these three code bases. That may be a bad sample since they're the ones that were done first anyway. But one of the questions that I had when I was thinking about this was how this transition related to the Discover Features Protocol. The Discover Features Protocol allows one agent to ask the other to disclose the features that they support. It occurred to me that it might be appropriate for an agent to report both the old and the new, depending as how that happened, so that the agents on the other side could perhaps have a confirmation of that or know which one they could default to. But it occurred to me that I don't think we had discussed the application of 348 onto the Discover Features Protocol. I don't know what that means, but I was just kind of curious if people have been through this. Was this a conversation that I managed to not be aware of, or where are we as it applies here? Any thoughts? Does it matter? Do we need to figure this out, or is it something we can ignore?
Well, 348 is an anomaly in the way we expect evolution to normally work. Normally, what we would do is we would increment a version number on a protocol when we're changing something. And in this case, when we're changing a prefix, actually, now that I think about it, the prefix is not significant to the, there's a semantic ambiguity. The way that we test the name of a protocol says that we rip off the prefix, which would mean that a protocol with the HTTPS prefix and a protocol with the DID prefix could theoretically be the same, which is a problem. I guess I'm getting off on tangents, but anyway, here's my point. 348 is doing some kind of an anomaly, and I don't want to change a long-lived protocol just to accommodate an anomaly. So I'm kind of hoping that the answer is yeah, we grit our teeth and get past this for the time being, and then we never have to worry about it again.
It also has to do with how heavily dependent we are on the Discover Features protocol. The toolbox is, it needs it, but I don't know how many other code bases are depending on it for various aspects of things.
Well, in the long run, I think we should be using it pretty, I won't say religiously, but we should be using it pretty often, because we shouldn't make strong assumptions that everybody we meet can talk to us in the same version that we want to talk and all that kind of stuff.
Right. I agree with you. So I think the two options we have, we don't necessarily have to change this RFC. That's not what we're talking about. But in the spirit of this RFC, if we're disclosing which protocols we support, and we support both, you know, the same protocol but with this prefix or that prefix, then that certainly seems to be a valid response here in the disclosed features, the Discover Features protocol.
Well, it's already possible in the Discover Features protocol to use a wildcard. And so we could use a wildcard to represent the prefix and just say, tell me whether you support */protocol X/1.0. The only question is whether you consider the answer to that question to be two separate answers if you support both of them.
Right. So in the toolbox implementation, we just use the protocol ID as a string match, meaning we're not evaluating stars. And so that could be a deficiency in that code base. I'm not claiming that's necessarily the correct way, but I think it's also possible when you disclose them to disclose two or not, right? If you say, hey, you know, tell me everything you just support, it's like a query within everything, right? Then you could just list the same thing twice. We don't have to solve this today, but I wanted to bring it up because it occurred to me. And if we run into it as a community, it might be helpful to have a conversation and come up with a plan on how it applies. So that was just one of the things that I hadn't thought of when we first talked about doing this transition that finally occurred to me.
It seems like a reasonable question, and I'd like to say that the answer ought to be the following. We treat protocols that differ only in prefix as different protocols. They might be the same or they might not. We don't take any opinion about it. We just simply say, well, it has different prefix, therefore they're different strings, so we'll think of them as different. And if people want to know whether you support, you know, both the prefix one and prefix two versions of the same protocol, they could use the wildcard to query. That's supported according to the RFC. And the party that's giving the response should consider every unique string that they return as a unique possible answer.
That sounds good. So summarizing, the application of that was that if you have support to receive both the old and new, you would list them both in a disclose message. Did I get that right?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay. Comments?
I mean, if we wanted to get pickier, we could say, don't return the both values unless you actually can both receive and send those values or something like that. But I think that's splitting hairs and it's not very important.
I certainly think in the age of our current community, that's not that big of an issue. Comments on this approach, thoughts? I don't know how urgent this is, meaning do we have to do this to become compliant with step one? I don't know. But I like the approach, Daniel, that you've proposed, and just returning both. I think that is useful. Any comments or thoughts?
I think with the approach we did in ACAPI, it will be returning both at the moment, which I hadn't really considered, but I'm okay with that.
I'd actually thought that when I saw the code and thought, I wonder if that's going to have the effect. I didn't trace it all the way through, though.
Yeah, because my original thought was that we would just rewrite the message type on incoming requests. But yeah, this way we advertise both.
Right. And we'd have to have some alternative logic to, in the rewrite the request land, we'd have to have some alternative logic to sort of double up on those replacement ones in the feature discovery.
Yes.
Okay, any other comments on this? Okay, I think that's probably as far as we need to take that conversation. Anything else that people want to have a conversation about? We're here. If you have something that you'd like to bring up, I'd love to hear about it.
Sort of related to that Discover protocol, did we decide how we're going to deal with minor versions and compatibility? Is there still an issue open for that?
I don't know. I thought we had decided, but now that you say that, I'm not entirely sure.
I thought that the resolution of that topic was a temporary resolution, and it was just everybody go read what had already been written about that topic in the SEMVER document under the protocols RFC. That's RFC 3. And then once people were comfortable that they wrapped their brains around what was already recommended, we would reconvene to talk more.
I believe that's correct. Stephen asked me to assign this to him, and he was going to chase it down and see if any updates were needed for clarification and relevant RFCs. So I think that is where we ended up.
So not resolved yet.
Well, we think it might be resolved in the existing RFCs. Is the argument that Daniel is making and hearing the issue as well.
Seems to...
Well, but we don't know that it's resolved. We just... the theory is there was some useful stuff said about this, so let's go read that before we start from scratch.
Perfect. So not resolved, we should do our homework. Is that a better summary?
Okay. Yeah. Something like that.
Is that maybe not the answer you're hoping for, but a sufficient one, Andrew?
Yeah, we'll look into it a bit more.
Okay. Excellent. Other topics?
If we have time and we have a quorum of people who are interested, I would like to talk about that GitHub issue, or excuse me, the PR and the spam issue that I was trying to explore there. But I don't want to co-opt our meeting, and only if we think there's a good quorum of people should we do that.
We have George, and of the people that have already commented on this, I think there is George and you. I think we're missing Stephen Curran. I would be the only missing person from that, and we could probably have a useful conversation anyway. And we're at the end of topics for the meeting, so if is anyone opposed to spending a few minutes on that? All right, let's do it. For background, Daniel, we're talking about the. Let me take an attempt, and then you get a rebuttal. In the out of band protocol, if we can communicate more about the context or the purpose of the actual out of band message, then it can help the recipient understand what the purpose is, or if they want to act on it, or things of that nature. So that was a piece of it. And you had talked about the ability to express goals and or protocols that were desired to happen, and had some thoughts about that. And then also you had a comment here where you talked about like connecting and dealing with spam, meaning agents finding out about other agents and sending them invitations to connect, and without some sort of spam prevention, then that could turn into kind of an awful problem. And so by providing context, it could really help with that circumstance. Is that a good summary of the spam question?
I'm trying to decide if I want to constrain this narrowly to the spam question or to the larger question, because you touched on a couple of other issues. Let me just explain the distinction. So spam is only about the issue of, should you establish a connection or invite somebody to connect without making any statement about what you intend to do when you're connected. And what I'm trying to claim in some of those comments is just that I think it would be a healthier ecosystem if the expectation was that every time you connected, you had to say, well, what do you plan to do? This is the same thing that's done on LinkedIn. When you go to make a connection with somebody, LinkedIn prompts you and says, invitations tend to be better accepted if you write a personal message. So that's the spam topic. There's other issues around this, like the idea that the way the spec is currently written, it assumes that the first mover in the next interaction will always be the sender. So I would like to connect with you. I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing, but once we are connected, I will send you a message and it will become clear what I want to do. That's kind of the assumption. And okay, I'll stop.
So, well, this may not be the right thing to say here, but it's occurred to me that there's context, because this is an out of band message. It's typically going to either be a link in an email, or it's going to be displayed on either a phone or a website to scan, that there's context surrounding the message that may not be present inside the message. So for example, an email shows up and says, hey, I would like to connect with you using this cool secure thing, let's do it. And then the link, or I'm logged into my bank's website. I'm trying to make these up off the top of my head. I'm logged into my bank's website and they want to, establish a connection doing this. And so the page says, hey, scan this with the whatever mobile app, and then we're connected, and then presents the QR code. And so in that way, there's context outside of the message. But you're talking about, specifically in the out-of-band protocol, but you're talking about placing context inside of the message itself that could have some additional properties or some reinforcement of that. Is that?
Yes. So one of the things that might be an interesting property is if you said, hey, let's connect. I want to engage in protocol XYZ version 1. And the person who receives the message says, well, I don't even know what protocol XYZ version 1 is, so there's no point in connecting. That's a useful thing to know before you go to the trouble of allocating a DID and, doing this dance with the person to exchange the DIDs and parse their DID doc and all that other jazz. So I think there's some usefulness to having programmatic context, not just human fuzzy context.
I think something like this goal suggestion works well for the invitation message. For the request message, it's already explicit, and you don't really need the sender to be the first mover after the connection, if a connection is required, because they've already moved, so to speak. The request that it contains is an agent message.
Right, but if you allow the invitation message to contain a goal, then you actually don't need the request message. They collapse to the same thing.
Does the goal contain an agent message? I thought it was just like a protocol.
Well, the agent messages are just attachments, and any DIDCOM message can have attachments. So you don't need a special message type to carry attachments.
Sorry?
What he's saying is that we're not necessarily expressing that in the goal, but you could also attach the message to the other invitation message. So there's a couple things here. One of the objections I had, Andrew, to the concept of including the message that I suggest you send me, I was worried about the security of that. And the announcing the protocol and the role actually helped solve that problem for me, because I can't just blindly act on that. I'd have to actually construct the message, which to me takes the danger part away. But then there's this other issue of how generalized we want this to be. And I'm bringing up something from another conversation on the same page, in that the out of band protocol describes two messages currently. One is a message that where the primary intent is to establish a connection. And the other one is where the primary intent is to have a not necessarily connected interaction. Like this is the ephemeral challenge that Tobias has championed. And if we generalized it more, we could accomplish kind of a whole lot more in this process as part of doing so. I mean, that's another issue. Daniel's arguing for more generalization, and I was offering an opinion and opposed to it. And so at least in this first version that we're trying to work on. So that was the other issue that I think relates here, is that we could, you know, also can, you know, have a message attached to the request, which, you know, is intended to create an invitation, meaning let's create a connection, and then here's a message you can then immediately operate on.
Yeah, I agreed with your concern in the original discussion there that could potentially be a security issue, especially if, you know, it's a request that somehow changes your relationship with that agent.
Right. Well, so are we actually saying, here's the actual content of a message I want you to send me, or here's the type of the message I want you to send me?
So that was the original proposal, it had an initial message. Your proposal with the goal avoids that issue, I think.
I would agree. I think the goal, listing the protocol and the role, clears that up nicely. The other goal I had here was to try and figure out how we could fit all of our needs, but in the simplest way possible. And I feel like the generalizing methods introduce some complexity that isn't necessarily helpful. And that particularly for really common use cases, trying to streamline those and make them as hard to screw up as possible is a useful attribute.
So what would be the common use case that you have in mind, Sam?
Creating a connection. So is that you and I meet?
The ordinary behavior of a mature ecosystem, people will just connect. That will be their main goal, is, hey, let's just connect. Nothing else.
Well, let me stick an asterisk on that. There's a couple of different cases. Sometimes it's just connect, meaning I just met you at a conference and I make a connection. And because it happens in front of me, I can then do stuff on my own to maybe like add you to a particular group of contacts or something like that. And that is a super valid from the person-to-person case. In the person-to-company case, I feel like the most common thing to do is going to be to establish a connection, and then the company will invite me to engage on stuff. So if it's my bank, for example, I'm going to connect, and then they might invite me to retrieve, I don't know, balance information or something. And the, you brought up an auction use case, right? If I'm connecting with an auction house on a particular item, the website already knows the particular item I'm looking at because of my context interaction with the website. And when I scan that QR code, the out of band protocol message is not necessarily going to tell me to sponsor a bid, but after I connect with that auction house or resume a connection, then as we've described, then they can respond and invite me to place a bid on that item. And I feel like that interaction model accomplishes almost all of the same goals, but in a much simpler way. Actually, I think it does accomplish all the goals, except that you have to come at it maybe with a particular strategy or a protocol that invites interaction. Instead of trying to include that first initial prompt that the client is supposed to respond to. So I guess.
I was just going to say, sometimes the goal might not be something that you want to expose either. You might want to share the invitation and then wait for a secure connection before you transmit anything else.
Let me just say this. I think there's a conflation going on between the very strictly defined connection protocol that we talk about and the process of connecting in a human context between a human and another human or a human and a corporation. If two humans meet each other at a conference, I don't think that their interaction will just be to run this connection protocol. It will be to connect in a human sense, and that probably means let's exchange DIDs and then let's also exchange business cards as verifiable credentials or something like it, so that we actually know a little bit about each other. I think that an ecosystem where you are just running the connection protocol as opposed to just doing a human connection is a different thing. And I don't think we want an ecosystem where it's good practice or encouraged at all to just connect with other agents for no reason, with no explanation, no strings attached. And we tell all of our agents that that's a good thing to do.
Well, to be clear, the out-of-band RFC is describing a protocol for situations where a human is always involved and there is always context surrounding its transfer. So I agree with you in the general sense when it actually comes to the process of executing the connection protocol, but this RFC is specifically talking about, you know, situations where there already is like human context involved, either person to person or person to organization.
You sure about that?
Yeah.
I'm not. I mean, if I want to just post a sign somewhere saying, hey, you know, I'm, you know, Acme Corporation, and if you ever want to, you know, connect to my website, I'm thinking about this on the outside of the building, for example, right? Connect to my website, here's, you know, here's my invitation message as a QR code, just scan it. So I'm standing outside the building and I scan that. There's no human context other than what I read on a sign, and just running a connection protocol and not doing a verifiable credential sets the expectation that you have enough context there to make good judgment. But if somebody, you know, slaps a sticker over the QR code and puts a different QR code, now I made a connection to Acme and I really didn't. We're training people that the connection protocol by itself is enough context.
So that's not at all what I intend. And I think that's a flaw with the connection protocol maybe, but not necessarily the out-of-band RFC. And so I think we need to promote the idea that a connection is just a connection. It has no bearing upon the, you know, anything else. That's why we have verifiable credentials in this ecosystem. So if I'm standing outside of a building and I say, yeah, I would like to connect, then after the connection is made, the natural, I believe as a community, we need natural things to happen next when you do a connection. Like, hey, what would you like to assert about yourself? And that's something that we can do, but I don't necessarily think that trying to bake it, at least at this phase that we exist as a community, I don't think that trying to bake it into the protocol at this point is going to be a helpful thing. Now, I'm not opposed at all to adding some of this more nuanced stuff to a future version of this, of the out-of-band protocol. I think that as we know more, it will be easier to know the types of interactions that we want to promote. I'm not at all opposed to that, but I am hoping that for this first initial version, it can be a little bit simpler since I feel like there's a lot we don't know.
Well, I think we're making, it's like we're at the very beginning of the dawn of email. And we're saying, yeah, let's deliberately ignore the spam problem. I feel like we're setting ourselves up for a disaster.
Well, so let's talk about the spam problem, because I don't think that's an issue at all as it relates to accepting or creating connections based on out-of-band RFC messages. Described in the out-of-band RFC is that If you are responding to an out-of-band message and jump into something like DidExchange, you use the thread ID of the out-of-band message as the parent thread ID of the message you actually send. And because that thread ID can be created by the person who's generating the out-of-band message, then they can use that in whatever context. For example, I can tell if you scan that sign on the outside of my building, or I can tell if you scanned that you know, from inside the employee break room, because I can generate unique ones for each and use that parent thread ID to establish the context of starting that new interaction that we are. And so I think it's perfectly reasonable, for example, let's say a company has a public DID and they receive a DidExchange request with no parent thread, or a parent thread that doesn't match, right? They could make one up, but if it doesn't match what I've got, it doesn't matter. Then that's something that I can totally choose to throw away. And so by having the out of band RFC, I believe the out of band RFC is the spam prevention problem, because it provides initial context that can help to filter out messages without a context, or with an invalid context because they're trying to fake something and just make up an ID.
It's interesting. I don't disagree with anything you said. I just think that you're talking about a different problem than I am. I'm talking about preventing spam for the person who receives the invitation. You're talking about preventing spam for the person who gets the follow-up, who gets the response to the invitation.
Oh, I hadn't detected that. You're concerned that people are going to see lots of QR codes and that's going to bother them?
I don't believe that this out-of-band mechanism can be constrained to QR codes. I think it's going to be used for IoT devices out-of-band. We're talking about ephemeral challenges being replaced by this mechanism, right? So all I have to do to bring an IoT device to its knees is send it millions of invitations, which its agent has been hard-coded to automatically accept, because we believe that accepting out-of-band invitations to connect is a good thing. And it will just simply accept all of them. And then I just sit around and do nothing with all of them, but I'm overwhelming its storage capacity by inviting millions of times in out-of-band messages.
So help me understand something. How does the IoT device get all these out-of-band messages sent to it?
Using some out-of-band channel.
There is no out-of-band channel. I mean, you could make one up. For example, maybe it receives it over an SMS or something, right? But it gets to decide about how it responds to those if it receives
them. No, because we're not giving it enough information to tell it how to decide.
So if I was designing an IoT device, I would not implement this out-of-band message protocol. I think it's an inappropriate protocol for the application.
But we're saying that the request message is supposed to be the replacement for ephemeral challenges, which is one of the major use cases for that is IoT devices.
Yes, but the request for an ephemeral challenge doesn't result in a connection. So you're not holding on to connections at all. You're executing that interaction, and then you're throwing that information away.
Personally, I don't even like to distinguish that much between having a connection and not. I think they should be considered sort of throwaway in general.
I'm of a similar opinion with some nuance, but I'm still trying to understand the spam problem as you see it, Daniel. I don't think I understand very well.
I don't know how to say it clearer. Maybe I should just hang up and we'll talk about it again. I think it's an important breakthrough that I'm not concerned about the other side of the spam problem. That feels irrelevant to me. The sender's responsible for starting this interaction. So if they get spammed, that's their problem. I'm worried about the recipient of the invitation being spammed.
Okay, so I would like to talk more when we figure out a better way to help me understand. The channels that we've come up with as examples on how you transfer an out-of-band message is in a link, either in an email or in a QR code.
Well, and just like any other message, it can be transmitted on any medium, any transport, right? As long as you're transmitting the bytes in some form, you've used an out-of-band channel. So email is an example of a medium that's rife with spam today that could be used to transmit invitations.
Yes.
Plain sockets could transmit these out-of-band invitations. Right?
Of course, but the context as I understood it, and maybe this isn't in the doc, the context as I understood it is that it's out of band in the sense that a human gets it and decides whether to act on it or not. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's the essence of our disconnect. Yeah, that's the part that I'm not buying. I don't think there's anything in this spec that says it must be humans, and there must be a nice human context that makes the out-of-band message a safe one to act upon using human judgment.
Oh, so we should talk about that. So Stephen's not on, but now that we've drilled down to actually what I think the issue is, and I agree with you that seems like the fundamental issue here. Once we get there, I'll bring that up in a comment on the RFC. So that we can talk about that specific issue. Because I totally misunderstood your comments that you had made about spam, because I thought you were talking about the other direction. Okay, so now that we've figured that out, we can talk more deeply about it and about whether the assumption that I've made is a correct one or not. And if it is, then we need to encode it so that it's not an assumption anymore. Right?
Okay, that sounds like good. It sounds like we made some good progress.
No, I appreciate that, because I totally misunderstood what you meant. Are there other aspects of this that you want to talk about? I think that was probably the biggest core issue.
So the way that the spec is currently written, the invitation is always an invitation to connect. Nothing more nor less, right? And the request is always a request for what?
The request is always a request that contains an inbound message, if you will, but to an unknown recipient. So that's how the ephemeral challenge one works. It prepares a message that is the beginning of that challenge, wraps it into the request, which then contains the routing information, et cetera, that we need to accomplish that, and then passes it via, you know, an out of band way to the recipient, who then
can I?
Yeah,
go ahead.
I was just going to say that the recipient then uses the internal message to then start the protocol, if you will, or continue the protocol that they started, but now there's some information attached to it, and then uses the connection information, the endpoint and keys and such from the request message level, and then continues the protocol.
So I think a request can have multiple messages on it, correct? In other words, it can have multiple messages attached to it.
I think we had envisioned, Andrew, you might recall this more accurately than I think we'd envisioned just one.
I think there was a suggestion to allow more than one, but as alternatives.
Instead of a sequence or something?
Yeah, like whichever format you happen to support.
So you send like two alternates and they're intended to be roughly equivalent.
Yeah.
But maybe different protocols or something. Yeah.
And we're using the attachments mechanism to add these messages, correct?
Yes.
So attachments are not constrained by number. Any message can have any number of arbitrary attachments, and you're just supposed to ignore ones that you don't understand. So how can I tell the difference between ones that I understand and ones that I don't? ones that are intended to be alternatives and ones that aren't?
I believe they were in line attachments instead of just generic attachments. Well, meaning, did I say that wrong, Andrew?
It's a named attachment decorator, right? It has to be, it's going to start with the request prefix, and it's either a list of attachments or it's a single attachment.
Right. So it's an attribute. It's like request tilde attach.
Yeah.
Okay. And so that's the one you're looking for, not just any attachments on the file or on that message.
Okay.
Is that better or worse than you had imagined?
Well, it wasn't better or worse. I just didn't understand what our mental model was about attachments very well. And I had read that through this, but I kind of was scratching my head when I got done with that part. Either I read it too fast or else the verbiage didn't teach me what you just taught me. So I'll have to go back and look and see if I just maybe just didn't read that well enough. So all I was trying to do is just trying to understand here.
Cool. And if there's a gap, and you can help us identify it, we can fill it. Other topics on the RFC, and this is open to anyone. Any future comments or issues you want to bring up?
I was just thinking about signing attachments because we had that old PR that we'd like to resubmit so we can support signed attachments in DidExchange.
Yes. I did look at that one. It was still lacking a few details about how the JWT was created, but the signature was a JWT, if I remember right.
Wouldn't the signature be a JWS, not a JWT?
Well, yes, but a JWT is a special form of a JWS. So we could just use a JWS.
A signature
to sign an attachment
that's a JWT is a special form in the sense that it only allows one signer and it requires the narrow form or the, you know,
compact form they call it.
So the question really would be, do we need the possibility to have a signature on an attachment that is more than one signer? And if the answer is yes, it has to be a JWS. If the answer is no, it can be a JWT.
There's a reason to rule it out.
Well, I was just thinking about like DID peer. Is there a sane reason why you would need an update to a DID document to be signed by more than one key?
Yes, absolutely.
Then we should allow it. Right? So this is one of the mechanisms we're hoping to use to transmit DID peer updates.
Yeah.
So in that case, it could just be a JWS, and it doesn't have to be in the compact form. That seems like an extra processing step.
Yeah, it could be a string in the compact form and an inline JSON in the expanded form.
Well, if it needs multiple signatures, like going with, it doesn't really make sense if we're going to have to do a JWT or a JWS. We should just do a JWS in one form or the other. It feels like allowing both the compact form and the JSON form feels like now I've got to handle two different things instead of just standardizing on one that means the same thing.
It would be nice to have the terseness of like a JWT compact form, but I think this is actually not going to happen that much. We'll have signed attachments occasionally, but in many other cases we won't. So I kind of think we should just go with JWS everywhere.
This also becomes relevant in the out-of-band protocol because we'd like to allow for signing the attachment, the request attachment, so that you know it's coming from the inviter. It hasn't been modified, especially if it's at an external URL or something.
That's interesting. So you want to sign the attachment, but you don't want to sign the overarching or containing message, or you want to sign both?
Primarily the attachment. But
interesting.
You know, there may be situations where the attachment is signed by one party and the message is signed by somebody else.
So that RFC, Andrew, I believe probably needs some rework then based on what we've talked about. Is that something you're pursuing or that is kind of up for someone else who wants the work?
I haven't been so far. Can look into that if nobody else is.
I hadn't yet, but that would be a really useful piece. Daniel, I know there's a lot going on with DidPeer and Carrie and stuff, but this feels like a necessary piece no matter what else is decided. Is that accurate?
Likely, yeah.
Okay, yeah, Andrew, I mean, I can, if I run out of the other stuff that I'm working on, I'll reach out and see if you've done it yet. But other than that, if you wanted to get started, then that'd be helpful.
Okay, same, because I'm working on the CredEx stuff at the moment.
Right. I may beat you to it, and then I can get going on that. I'll have to have someone that understands all the details, double check the things I write to make sure that they're accurate. But I can get that going too. Because that's one of the missing pieces that we'll need for DidExchange. Awesome. Other comments, questions, topics? I don't know what part of a Nathan that was because I wasn't counting, but that seems sufficiently long. Thank you for the discussion and Daniel for bringing up and digging into the out of band stuff and continuing that conversation a little bit more. I will get my comments into an issue sometime. I don't know what time today it will be, but I'll get it in there. And I think we're done. Any final comments that anyone wants to make before we close the meeting? Awesome. Well, thank you all for coming. This we made far more progress than I had hoped to, given the lining up with a major conference. So this is very good. May everyone have a fantastic week, and we will see you on Rocket Chat and in the issues. Thanks, folks.
Thank you.